Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 161 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling The Old World Order is Dead. Long live the New World Order. About Peter Zion's presentation at the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention held November 13th to the 16th at the Grand Hotel in downtown Spokane. This is not the first time that Zion, who bills himself as a global strategist, has appeared before the Grain Convention. In November 2016, his presentation became my episodes 54 and 55, entitled Hold On Tight, The World According to Peter Zion. If you haven't already listened, you should take the time to call up those earlier episodes to see how well they've aged. Go to the Washington Grain Commission website, wagrains.org, click on Podcast Summaries at the bottom of the page, and navigate back into time. When I saw Zion on the schedule of the 2019 convention, I wondered if enough time had elapsed for him to significantly update his 2016 presentation. Then again, a lot has happened in the last 3 years. From Zion's perspective, we may be living through the most consequential moment in U.S. history since at least the end of World War II. Which happens to be when the U.S. imposed its version of free trade on the world and subsidized the trade of other nations in return for peace. But that era is ending, and something much less expansive is going to replace it, Zion predicts. Although this new world order will result in world famine, the likes of which the planet hasn't seen in 200 years, Americans will be insulated from the turmoil, and U.S. agriculture will benefit. Although Zion's logic makes his vision of the future appear inevitable, predictions don't always work out. I wish Zion would have included a timeline for when all these changes are going to happen. Like the proverbial aircraft carrier, I suspect that completing the turn from one new world order to another will take some time. When Zion says change is coming, I wonder how long. Zion began his presentation referring to a future that will put millions of people's lives around the world in jeopardy. There just won't be enough calories to go around. I have posted many of Zion's slides to the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page. This presentation has been edited for length.
Let's start with the punchline. This is a global calorie map. Countries in the deep blue export a huge percentage of the grain-based calories that they produce. Dark green's pretty good too. Everyone else in the world is a net importer of their calories. Countries in orange and red import at least half. And in the world that I see, these are the countries that are looking at a 40% or greater reduction in their ability to grow the crop in the first place. Now, I look at this and you know what I see? Famine. Continental in scope. On a scale that we have not seen in two centuries. It's coming, it's inevitable. You will try to feed the world, you will fail. There aren't enough of you. But you'll laugh all the way to the bank. Global demand will drop. Global supply will crater. And you're going to be some of the last men standing. Okay. We're going to build to this now with everything else. This is what trade used to look like. We didn't trade goods. We traded ammo. And if you saw something you thought you needed, you went out and you took the damn thing. You confiscated it. You colonized it. You expanded into empire. And those empires fought over resources and access and markets and populations. Those fights turned into wars. Those wars brought us World War II, which took the entire system and crashed it to the ground. That left it to the last man standing, the Americans, to figure out what's next. So we drew our allies together, and we said, we're going to try something new this time. We're going to use our Navy, the only one to survive the war, to patrol the global oceans so that anyone can go anywhere at any time, purchase any raw commodity, ship it home safely, metabolize it into a finished good, and then export it for hard currency. In addition, we will protect you. We will put you under the nuclear umbrella. There's just one catch. You have to be on our side. We bribed up an alliance to fight the Soviets, and it gave us this map. The deep blue are the countries that we cared about before the war. The medium blue are the new allies in this new global order, the first global order. Orange are the other guys. We don't like to talk about them. And the light blue is the field of competition. We could never deny battle because the credibility of the alliance system was at stake. We didn't get involved in Korea and Vietnam because we liked rice. We were the world's largest rice exporter at the time. We did so to prove to the Germans, to the French, to the Japanese that we would bleed for them. But then one idle Tuesday, on the very definition of pent-up demand, the Germans had a party and it was all over. And it never occurred to us that we might actually win in anything less than a nuclear exchange. And almost overnight, our view of the world changed. There's a lot of gray up there, a lot of places that we just don't have a firm opinion on. Now, the person who was in charge the day the wall fell is George Herbert Walker Bush. From a foreign policy point of view, he is arguably the best president this country has ever had. He served as vice president. He ran the CIA. He ran the Office of Budget. He served in the House of Representatives. He was ambassador to China. He had excellent relations with everyone on both sides of the American political aisle. He had first name relationships with all the world leaders who mattered. He was the right person, in the right place, in the right job, with the right disposition and the right skill set at the right time. So of course we voted him out of office. And we started down the parade of morons. Bill Clinton is arguably the smartest person to sit in the West Wing since Jefferson himself. But he had a, how should we put this, an attention deficit issue. He also saw himself as a leader of national renewal. He really wasn't interested in foreign affairs. And when he realized that he had a summit the next morning, he would kind of hunker down with the State Department and the CIA desk officers and cram for it like he was back in college and he was having a test. He was a millennial before his time, if you will. And he would hit it out of the park every single time. He was so good in small group settings. Relations would soar for a day because there was never any follow-up. In 8 years of the Clinton administration, we really only had about 2 months of foreign policy. Then we had W, and you know, let's call it what it was. We had a monochromatic foreign policy that dealt with one issue in one region and to hell with everything else. Barack Obama comes along, and Barack was a very intelligent gentleman. He gave a series of kind of exit interviews with the press in his final 6 months as president, and he demonstrated a command, a deep understanding of the context and the details of everything the country faced. Why green power with the technology we have today for in most places actually increases your carbon footprint. Why the Russians do what they do. Why the Israeli-Palestinian conflict isn't going to be solved by the peace process. He really did get it. He understood. But he had this really weird personality quirk for a leader. He hates people. No American president went to Congress fewer times than Barack Obama. No American president met with his cabinet secretaries fewer times. None met with his party affiliates fewer times. He hated having conversations. And so for 8 years, we didn't have a foreign policy at all. You guys remember Thousand Points of Light, the New World Order? That was Herbert Walker Bush's attempt to get us as a nation to have a conversation with ourselves about what we wanted out of the world, what we wanted to do with this order now that the Soviet Union was gone. And we punished him for it. And just as making a bad decision has consequences that can last decades, so does refusing to make a decision at all. The glory and the horror of Donald Trump is that at his core, he's got a really good point. The global order that we created to fight the Soviets no longer serves American strategic needs. It hasn't since the wall fell. But economically, it was never supposed to. We subsidize the Allies. The Allies fight the Soviets. That was the deal. It was a bribe. And when you're no longer getting anything for your bribe, you can stop paying it because you're not invested in it. And that's exactly what we're doing. And that's okay. Because we never put our economy on the line. We're the least involved economy in the world. We are not a trading nation. Last year, only 8% of GDP came from exports. About half of that's within NAFTA. We can, we will, we are designing a local security and economic system without needing a global one. So the question then becomes, if the Americans are stepping back, if we are past the point of no return, and I would argue that we are, can anyone pick up the mantle? Is there anyone out there who can replace, displace the United States as the sole superpower? Well, there's two things you need. First of all, you have to be able to provide security. Roughly 95% of international trade is on the water, so you have to make sure that the sea lanes are safe for everyone. Let's look at that. Now, the carrier on the right, that's a jump carrier. The one on the left, that is a super. On the deep blue sea, without support from land-based assets, you need at least 7 jump carriers to fend off a single super carrier. Now, there are 21 jump carriers in the world. 11 of those are American flagged. There are 11 super carriers in the world. All are American flagged. At current rates of global naval build-out, the combined navies of the rest of the planet will roughly equal American naval firepower today in the year 2240. As an American, I don't lose a lot of sleep over this. By the way, the Chinese have one jump carrier. They didn't build it. The Soviets did in the 70s, and it used to be a casino. Context, people. Okay, so there's no country, there's no coalition of countries that can even theoretically displace the United States in the remainder of this century. Just can't happen. What's the other piece? It's consumption. Ultimately, trade doesn't work if there's no one on the other end buying it, right? Let's look at that. This is a demographic profile. You've got children at the bottom, young adults, mature adults, retirees at the top, men on one side, women on the other. This is what we call a consumption-led demographic. This is Mexico. Now, anytime you have a bulge in your population structure roughly below age 40, it's all about the spending. Raising kids, buying homes, buying cars, going to college, smoking pot, spend, 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 spend. Well, that really brings the house down in Denver. Oh, well. Now, when American political and business leaders look at a country like Mexico, we like what we see. It's a large consumption-based system. They can absorb a lot of imports. And in addition, people who are under age 40 are new at what they do. They don't have a lot of experience. They're relatively low value added in their work. So the products they produce tend to be more on the assembly and low skill side. And that's perfect for us, because that's not what we're good at. We do high-end and we do design. So the trade opportunities between two systems, one like Mexico, one like the United States, are legion. Mexico has become our largest trading partner. It is a position they will not give up in our lifetime. This is a partner. This is not. Canada had a baby bust 40 years ago. They never recovered. Now, they've got a bulge in their population structure in their 50s and 60s. Now, these folks are very smart, very experienced. They've been doing what they've been doing for 20, 30, 40 years. Very high value added. They compete directly with the American worker base. And because there's so many of them in that thin chunk at the top, they have supersaturated their own labor market. That has pushed down the cost of their relative labor costs, and along with it, the cost of the goods that they produce. But because there aren't a lot of people in Canada in their 20s and 30s, they can't consume what they produce locally. They have to send it abroad, and 80% of it comes here. Canada is no longer a complementary system. It's a competitive one. And that evolution for both Mexico and Canada is now reflected in American trade policy and foreign policy. Now, if you can't get your birthright back up, eventually you age into something like Japan. How do you run a first world economy without a workforce? You automate, not because you want to, not because you're good at it, because you have no choice. So they are the world's leader in robotics. Funny thing about robots, they don't vote yet, which means it doesn't matter where you put them. So Japan has become the world leader not in outsourcing or in resourcing, but something called desourcing. Picking up huge chunks of their industrial plant, dropping it into other countries where they can get on the safer side of currency risk, political risk, supply chain risk, energy risk. Purchasing friends, build where you sell. The four largest facilities that Toyota operates are in Kentucky and Texas, not by accident. Now here's us, we're kind of in the middle, and there's two generations we need to talk about. So right here at the top, this group here, these are our baby boomers. The baby boomers are the largest generation as the percentage of the population in American history. And their concentration in that zone has made the United States capital rich. Think about how you invest. When you're 35, you put a small sliver of a small income away for the future. When you're 55, you put a big fat wedge of a much larger income away. And when you're 64 and 3/4, you shove every possible penny you can in. Capital supplies get bigger. Terms get easier as you age until you hit a certain point, because the day you retire, you never add to that again. So the capital supply gets bigger and easier, simpler terms, and all of a sudden it falls off a cliff. That cliff is 3 years from now. That's the year that the majority of the American baby boomers will have retired, which means that in that year, average capital costs in the United States will roughly quadruple. All at once. This means that in the short term, lending is easy. All that money is there waiting, and the boomers are seeking that mythical extra 1% of return before they retire, and that has pushed them to put their money into projects that in retrospect maybe weren't the best idea. This is Enron and Brick and Subprime and Disco. You know, none of this should have ever happened. And in 3 years, it's all over. Okay, next generation down that really matters right here. We got the millennials, folks that are in their 20s and 30s these days. Now, I normally like to spend about 45 minutes of every presentation talking about why the millennials are a waste of skin, but we don't have that kind of time today. It's good to see some millennials here today, you know, awake. So instead, we're going to talk about all the reasons that we should all be grateful that they're here, seriously. Now, for you who are Xers and boomers in the room, don't worry, this won't take long. There's really only three reasons. So, number one, consumption. All those boxes of filet mignon dog food, and all those juice bar memberships, and all those goddamn scooters. They add up. Millennial consumption is the sole factor that has kept the United States out of recession since the year 2009. Without them, we would have had at least two recessions. That is amazing. Second, if you fast forward to the year 2030, when the millennials are in charge, they will fill out the tax-paying class in a way that my generation, Gen X, never could. There is a light at the end of the fiscal tunnel. It is not a train. It is a millennial. Whether that makes you happy or sad is entirely up to you. Third, we think of the millennials in this country as the alpha and the omega, the end all and the be all. In reality, they're all alone. Almost everywhere else in the world, we had a population bust like Canada, like Japan. And if you look at the rich world demography without the Americans in it, it's a retirement community. The global order is based on global consumption, and that is ending. Even if the Americans wanted to maintain the global system, it wouldn't work. Quick look around at the countries that we think of when we think of the next big powers. Here are the Chinese. Newsflash, folks. 25 years after the one-child policy, they've run out of 25-year-olds. Never let anyone tell you that the Chinese are good at math. It is not true. South Korea is a little younger, but aging faster. Thailand, just a little bit behind. Over in Europe, you know, if there's a country that can't have an open, honest conversation about population policy, that would be Germany. And if there's any country that we were convinced had figured out how to have a lot of kids, that would be Italy, right? Apparently not. Spain, marginally better. In New Europe, Poland's nearing mass retirement faster than we are. Even if you believe Russian data, this is still a terminal demography. There we go. Brazil, country of the future, right? Yeah. Direct your eyes to the top of that graphic. This is 30 years ago. Here's Brazil today. They are aging at 6 times the American rate, and the average American will be younger than the average Brazilian by the year 2042. The average American has been younger than the average Chinese for 2 years already. In fact, there are only 2 countries in the advanced world with a demography even remotely similar to ours. And while the French can handle the catering and the Kiwis can man the bar, a global order that does not make. This had to end anyway. Which means, when the Americans step back, countries, whether out of desperation or opportunity, will be forced to take matters into their own hands. And none of them can provide a regional, much less a global system. That means shooting. These are the areas that are going to see the greatest conflagrations. Now, for those of you who know your history, you will recognize that these are the places that have seen most of the major wars throughout human history. It's where the world's cultural tectonic plates slam together. For those of you who know your economics, you will know that since 1946, these are the parts of the world that have seen the greatest economic growth. Because the Americans forced everyone to be on the same side and stopped those wars. It was a base effect growth burst that lasted for 70 decades. I'm sorry, 7 decades. And it's now over. And now we go back to something more normal.
Going back to something more normal in world trade wouldn't concern me if 2 world wars hadn't preceded the last 70 years of relative peace. Zion, however, is very optimistic when it comes to America's position in his world of the future, especially given the nation's abundance of shale oil and natural gas, which has created an energy market independent of world trade. Zion has only gotten started in episode 161, so be sure to join me next week for episode 162 when he assesses world leaders' contrasting approaches to dealing with President Trump, especially the marked difference between the leadership of South Korea and Japan, countries that are both important markets for Pacific Northwest wheat exports. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of a presentation by global strategist and author Peter Zion, who spoke November 15, 2019 at the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention at the Grand Hotel in downtown Spokane. Please join me again next week for the second part of The Old World Order is Dead, Long Live the New World Order, right here on Weed All About It!
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in its head. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our glue, our dough. Always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.